All right, welcome to The Nose. It's the end of the week. It's been an exciting week for us here on the Colin. I mean, just they all are, but here on the Colin McEnroe Show. It was an exciting week. I won't go into why. So here on the show today, well, we all went out to the movies to see the movie I, Tonya. It, of course, is a recounting of this thing that kind of gripped the nation. I would call it a scandal. That, of course, was... Although it really isn't a movie about the kneecapping of Nancy Kerrigan. It's about something else. And we'll figure out what that something else is in our second segment today. But before we do that in the first segment, is there a Bruno Mars backlash? And if so, does it have something to do with accusations of cultural appropriation by Bruno Mars of song elements and tropes that aren't really part of his own ethnicity? Although God knows his ethnicity should be just a free pass to get in just about anywhere. But and then Richard Roper is perhaps the first actual casualty in a story that broke in the New York Times last weekend. Page one story about the incredible industry of fake Twitter followers. Richard Roper, one of the people who appears to have purchased bot-driven fake Twitter followers. He's, of course, a Chicago Tribune movie critic. He has been suspended from his job for that. We'll talk about whether that makes sense or not. But we're going to start with Bruno Mars. First of all, we should say that Bruno Mars won a lot of Grammys this past weekend. A lot of Grammys. Album of the Year, Record of the Year, Song of the Year, Best R&B Performance, Best R&B Song, Best R&B Album. Bruno Mars is there and all of that. Let's hear a little bit of Bruno and Cardi B doing Finesse. So I'm sitting here chair dancing, and Carolyn Payne, one of our panelists, is, of course, making for the door, which is what she does when Bruno Mars starts to play. Carolyn Payne is an actress, comedian, dancer. She's a founder, a director, and choreographer of Kinetic Dance. She's recovering from a broken ankle, but she's more mobile now. She could actually get out of here just to escape Bruno Mars, but she chooses not to. Rand Richards Cooper, a contributing editor at Commonweal, writes the In Our Midst column for Hartford Magazine. Parker Who, making her debut on The Nose, although not on our show. She's been on before. A graphic designer who performs with a bunch of local bands. She's making her Nose debut. I just said that. Her brand new solo album is Late Reply. It's available at parkerwho.bandcamp.com. Parker, let's start out. I mean, well, one way that we could sort of argue that there's something of a Bruno Mars backlash is just a lot of articles circulating on the web, including sometimes to us in our emails. Is Bruno Mars guilty of cultural appropriation? Asks one. Bruno Mars must be stopped. 24K Magic album review. Bruno Mars and the appropriation of black music. And a fourth article is Bruno Mars black. 450,000 Google questions about his ethnicity, race, nationality, and parents' background. So you can sort of make, I mean, first of all, well, you've got one theory about what's happening here.
My theory is the question is actually, is Bruno Mars too popular? Mm-hmm. As we were saying before, I think in general people like to root for an underdog, especially musicians, the undiscovered band. But once they reach a certain popularity threshold, you know, it turns into, well, you know, they're a hack for this or whatever reason.
Now we must destroy this person.
Yes.
We have built this person.
Unless you're Beyonce, where I feel like she actually, that hype like rises her up even higher.
I suppose. I mean, I guess it would depend on who you're asking. I know there's definitely a lot of people out there who are very anti-pop music. Anything that's highly commercial, just take much offense to it.
I mean, that's my problem with Bruno Mars. I feel like a lot of his songs are just, I mean, not like you want your pop music to be really deep, because I think that's kind of the whole point of pop music is to just kick back and listen to something fun. I just find some of his songs so annoying, except I do happen to like that Finesse song that we just played because it has this like 90s, you know, New Kids on the Block, Paul Abdul sound to it that I'm into. Mm.
So, but Rand, one of the specific allegations being made, if it could be called an allegation against Bruno Mars, is that he's a lot of things, but he's not black. He was born in Hawaii to a Puerto Rican and Jewish father and a Filipina and Spanish mother. I guess his real name is Peter Gene Hernandez. I hadn't really known that. I like calling him Bruno Mars. But I mean, this is like a really old question. Is like how many tropes can you borrow from various kinds of quote unquote roots music that aren't part of your roots?
So I don't have that much to say about Bruno in particular. The few times I've heard him, I've liked him. I liked his Super Bowl thing. Was that last year or the year before?
Year before.
But the term cultural appropriation has been in the conversation a lot in recent years, and it's a pretty interesting topic. The idea behind it is that there are certain cultural traditions that are in effect proprietary. And that you qualify to partake in them by virtue of actually belonging to the tradition out of which they grew, the ethnic tradition. Before we do away with the idea that there might be something legitimate in this, because I'm ultimately really very opposed to the idea, maybe it's worth trying to understand, you know, where it comes from. And part of it has to do with the sense that other cultural traditions that are other are often travestied and insulted. So a lot of the talk of cultural appropriation on campus had to do with, for instance, you know, like people throwing taco and tequila parties, you know, where frat boys wear sombreros. And this is perceived to be insulting to people of Mexican culture. So one source for the idea of cultural appropriation is the idea of cultural travesty and insult. The other is that of sort of professional exclusion and the galling nature of seeing someone, you know, like if you go back to the history of Motown, seeing white artists take your music that you're like barely getting by with a career singing it, and then they make millions of dollars.
Pat Boone made a lot of money,
right,
singing Little Richard songs.
Right, the Pat Boonification of black music.
And Little Richard was not making a lot
of
money.
So you understand where this idea comes from, but in terms of how it actually applies to artists and to art, it's really problematic, you know, because all art involves constantly this constant churn and mixing of traditions. Whether you're talking about literary art or music, if you restrict artists from crossing boundaries, taking things and merging them into fantastic and cool new hybrids, hybrids, it's certainly true narratively, certainly true musically, then the whole thing really grinds to a halt.
Well, is it that people didn't know what, because I actually didn't know that he wasn't black until I had looked that up. So I'm wondering if people have this sense of feeling because he surrounds himself, his whole band are black. Like, I wonder if it's the sense where people are like, oh, hey, wait a second, that's not what you are. Is it that they felt like he misrepresented?
That he's actually pretending and committing a fraud in
a way?
Not
that he's like pretending, but it's just that you wouldn't necessarily know. I mean, it doesn't matter to me what his ethnicity is. I think some of his songs are good and some are just earworms. But
well, let's first of all circle back to the actual musician in our midst. But before we do that, I want to play a little clip. This is, as Jonathan points out, the third time on the show that I've asked for a clip from part of this conversation. It was on a podcast that I really like a lot, the Slate Culture Gabfest. They do this thing called the Summer Strut episode where they sort of look at the songs that they really want to hear a lot while they're walking around during the summer. And Ed Sheeran came up. And it turned out that most of the people on the show didn't really quite understand who Ed Sheeran was. They're not rock critics or anything like that. They knew that there was such a person as Ed Sheeran, and they were kind of vaguely aware of him. They were asking a lot of questions. But the rock critic who was on the show, Chris Malanfi, kind of went after Ed Sheeran in a very specific kind of way.
Ed Sheeran will do whatever he has to do to have a hit. I don't want to make him sound utterly craven, but like, has he done hip-hop? Yes. Has he done folk? Yes. Has he done EDM? Yes. You know, he's even got a hit on his current album called Galway Girl, which is kind of like a post-Coors Irish step dancing kind of song. Like, he will do that. Whatever it takes to get a hit, homeboy will do that.
All right. First of all, if you're attacking somebody for cultural appropriation and you're a white rock critic and you use homeboy as a pronoun, you have committed the very sin probably that you are attacking. But Parker, like, musicians are they're syncretists. They musicians just listen to stuff that they like and work it into the stuff that they do. I mean, I don't know. Is it unfair to attack somebody for their eclecticism?
I certainly don't think so, and actually, I don't think it really matters whether you're a musician or you're just a lover of the arts or if you are really into accounting but just have a huge eclectic music taste. It's, you know, people like what they like, and it's interesting what you said before, Rand, about the cultural appropriation, and you really limit the artistic process when you try to keep people within their bounds. Because that's the evolution of arts, of culture. I mean, that's kind of why I feel like it's just picking a reason to hate. You know, maybe one of the reasons people have an opposition to Bruno Mars for whatever they think he should be is, oh, well, you know, he seems like he should fit into this bucket, but he doesn't. Well, what the heck? But you could also go another route and say, well, he is only there because he's attractive, which is another argument that gets made a lot.
He was an Elvis impersonator. He was like the world's youngest Elvis impersonator, right?
That's how he took his first
that's
step
how he
toward
got, yeah.
there. But there, he may be there for a variety of other reasons.
Right, but I mean, that he got that was like his big break. I think he was even in a movie playing a little Elvis impersonator right. when he was like a little kid.
But Parker, do people say that about Bruno Mars? He's only there because he's
No,
he's
not
handsome?
Specifically. Oh, okay. I kind of just think about that because there's actually, I was just having a conversation with another musician the other day about this, saying that, oh, well, so-and-so wouldn't be here if he or she wasn't attractive, mm-hmm. which is kind of true. If you don't look like you're going to stand out, that's part of the marketing and success of
I think
being
the performing
musician.
Arts are a visual medium
Very much so.
At the end of the day, and
yeah.
I think that
Well, particularly in the advent of videos. I mean, Uptown Funk is a lot of different things, but it's a video, too, that people like, and it has, like, a certain aesthetic going on in it, too. Well, you know, so, Rand, just to go back to one other point, let's set aside cultural appropriation, too. I think there's sort of another thing that annoys people, and that is songs that really do become so incredibly popular that everybody knows them and can sing them. And so at that point, they're wrenched out. All the people who've gone to a lot of trouble trying to be cool, you know, and have spent a lot of time, you know, with D'Angelo's Black Messiah album or something like that. And then, like, along comes Uptown Funk, and every idiot 63-year-old white guy like me knows all the words and can dance to it. There's something grating about that, too, even though we think pop music really should be for everybody.
Well, I think two things that are grating about it is, one, some of these melodies, they do insinuate themselves into your mind in a way that proves tormenting over time. And is Ed Sheeran the I'm in love with the shape of you guy?
Yes, that is who Ed
so,
Sheeran is.
So, wow. I mean, you know, the number of times, because my daughter, who's 12, yeah. Listens to that. So, you know, and I have lit into this song for all of its retrograde sentiments. And, you know, but there I am after delivering this lecture to her about how wrong these lyrics are. And then, you know, I'm walking around the house going, I'm in love with your body. And she'll say, Dad, what are you humming? So these songs defeat you and torment you at that level. But in terms of the success and homeboy trying anything to have it, obviously anyone who has anything invested in being a sort of cutting edge artist faces a terrible dilemma once success crashes over him, you know, him or her. And artists have been put in that amusing situation again and again and again. And each has to find her or his way, you know, to deal with popularity and success. Well, I don't have to, but I mean, those who have that wave crescendo over them do.
See, I should be honest about this and say that I live in two different worlds. In this world that I'm in here in the studio, I sort of think, you know, that Bruno Mars and Ed Sheeran are the kinds of pop artists that they're good pop artists and they make good pop that people like. And, you know, I mean, it's not really complicated or thoughtful pop, or it's not, I mean, if you really want to immerse yourself in something else. But for what pop music is, which is, you know, sort of party music and car music and stuff like that, I mean, I think they're actually very good at it. Okay, that's this world, and that's my official position on this show. Now, I happen to live with somebody, Rand, who is not 12 years old, who is not anything close to 12 years old, who is part of my generation, who would, if allowed, have Ed Sheeran and Bruno Mars and a lot of other stuff on in the car for long drives all the time. and I take a completely different position there. My position might be summed up as I'm going to jump out of this car while it's moving if this doesn't stop pretty soon. So,
and yet it comes on. I have seen Colin, you know, break it down to up-down funk at a party, and so it comes on there, and you lose all control. But in the car, like, right, that's too much?
She, in all fairness, Carolyn saw that over her shoulder as she was running away from the party where up-down funk was playing. All right, well, we should move on here anyway. I think you can enjoy Bruno Mars without feeling as though you're doing anything wrong. But that's just me. So Richard Roper is a film critic. As I said before, there was a massive New York Times page one, lead the paper story. They had uncovered this this enterprise, this industry that is basically involved in creating fake Twitter accounts that often seem to mirror actual Twitter accounts. So there's the real Parker Who on Twitter, but then there's another Parker Who just like says all kinds of things and follows all kinds of people. And that particular Parker Who, the fake Parker Who, can be bought and sold. And that's what people do. They actually sell. There's one company in particular that sells by the thousands and maybe by the millions, the fake Twitter accounts that are kind of bot operated. And people who want to have a lot of Twitter followers for a variety of different reasons buy these. And it came out that John Leguizamo had done such a thing. A bunch of other celebrities had done it. But also Richard Roper, who's a critic for a newspaper, had done it. And he has been suspended for that. So I have my own thoughts about this. But Rand, why don't you start us off here?
So I would start from this point. Roper is a man of a certain age, right, Colin? He's not a young guy. And it's ironic in an emblematic way for where we are now that a movie critic, someone whose function in this sort of entertainment machine that we have, used to be to serve as the mechanism whereby a movie would gain popularity. That person now has to go out and find, in effect, movie critics in order to credential himself. I mean, nothing could speak more fully to the sort of replacement of the gatekeeping mechanism that critics used to play than this particular story. So I find it ironic in that way. I mean, he is still the movie critic, but he's nobody if he doesn't have these people out here supporting him.
That's exactly it. I mean, the word credential. So, you know, I'm an actor and a comedian, and when you are meeting with like your agent or if you're part of a project, they're looking to see how many followers you have. That is a huge, and I'm sure it's the same in music when you're meeting with managers there. But they also want to make sure that they are real followers. You know, they'll go through, and if you have, like on Instagram, if you have like 10,000 followers but you're only getting like 50 likes a picture, that math doesn't add up, and they can tell that you bought those followers and they're not genuine. So, and it goes so far as a lot of times they tell you want to have, they want to see engagement, meaning that it's true people who are commenting and everything like that. So this, when I saw this headline, I laughed about it because last spring when I was out in LA working on a project, and this was something that was it was getting a lot of talk out there because a lot of actors are buying followers to pad up their social media and to get their foot in the door with agents and into production. Because the more followers you have, sometimes the more likely they are to hire you for that project, believe it or not.
I mean, it may be a faulty assumption that Parker has to play this game because you do like art rock. You probably have to prove that you don't have any Twitter followers.
Oh, yeah, true.
Like
I don't know if I would.
Maybe you want to be the
No, we don't
there.
Do art rock. But I do work in marketing, and the engagement term makes me laugh a little bit. Because on one hand, I totally understand why a film critic now has to buy his own critics to build up his credentials, because it's all a numbers game, as you're saying. And now that any person can have their own Twitter handle or whatever it is, they've essentially become their own brand. And if you have your own brand, you have to take care of your brand, like you have to water your garden. and then it becomes a natural inclination to you know, add supplements. It's kind of
buy artificial, you know, fertilizer for
that. Yes, exactly.
But you know, the reason I asked if he's a man of a certain age is that you know, I feel one of the great liberations of midlife generally is that you gradually are able to free yourself from the vice-like grip of popularity, of caring as much about what other people think of you. Much of social media seems like a structural conspiracy to keep us involved in sort of adolescent and young adult, the throes of popularity-related mm-hmm. dilemmas and stratagems that it used to be by the time you were Richard Roper's age, you know, you didn't care. You had the great blessing of not caring about that. Not only now do you have to care about, like, who likes you. It's not only a status thing. It's a commercial currency. Mm-hmm. And in that way, this seems like a perfect storm of badness in certain ways. But it is what it is. And once that reality is there, it was inevitable that a market would be there for it, and then that companies like the one in that article would develop in order to serve the market.
And it's incredibly cheap to buy followers.
Right.
Too.
It's like a penny, a penny a pop, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think you can buy like 1,000 followers for like $5 or something like that. So I can understand how the temptation is there. Like, you're like, oh, this will help.
Well, speaking of pennies, let me offer my 2 cents about this. First of all, I actually dispute what you're saying, Rand. I actually think that people who are in the public eye, people who are doing jobs that involve public visibility and having some kind of public audience, they all care about that. If, you know, anybody who thinks that, you know, that Anthony Lane doesn't care if he has more readers than, you know, some other film critic, nah, they all care. Nobody ever stops caring about that. They may be able to make it a more dignified process, but they still care. Now, I do think that there's two wrongs that are committed here that probably are worth addressing. One of them is, if you work in journalism, which film critics are sort of at least nominally part of, you don't want to be saying things that aren't true. That's one of the things we don't do, right? Ideally, we don't mislead people about things. So if he's in fact intentionally misleading people about a pretty trivial question, how many Twitter followers he has, he's kind of departed from maybe one of the two or three absolutely bedrock codes of journalism. It's the kind of thing that you don't have to be told on your first day of work. So there's a little bit of a problem there. I think there's also kind of a harm. And the harm is not to him or not to us by being misled by him, but by, I mean, as the Times piece made clear, if you, Carolyn Payne, don't particularly like Richard Roper and wouldn't follow him, but there's some kind of bot-driven Carolyn Payne copy account that's following Richard Roper and can be obviously noticed and documented, that's an injury to you. An injury is being committed to you. And so you have to at least sort of acknowledge those two things from an ethical standpoint. Having said all that, I also feel like, you know, Tronc or whoever he works for, I think it is Tronc, they probably don't have any policy about this because they never thought about it because companies are too big and stupid to understand everything that's kind of happening out there. And I don't think you should suspend somebody for violating a policy you don't have. All right, now I'm done.
They have to catch up with the policy. The Slate article is very smart in saying institutions are going to need to draw a clearer line between what is merely distasteful, tacky self-promotion and what is a serious breach of journalistic ethics. And, you know, this stuff changes rapidly enough that the institutions, not to mention laws, I mean, is some of this stuff going to be illegal? Is it actually commercial fraud? Who knows what box to put this in?
I didn't think of it from the ethical standpoint because I saw it from my professional standpoint of where I know a lot of, you know, up and coming actors and comedians who do that because you pad it a little and then people see like, oh, a lot of people are following this person. It helps you gain followers. And I see where that temptation lies. But I didn't think of it from if you do have a job where ethically you are responsible for, you know, being a truth teller and in delivering news like that. That is different than, you know, an actor who is trying to cultivate fans, like their whole point with their social media is to grab attention. So where numbers are an attention grabber in his position.
Right. We expect a certain amount of falsification from actors. I do want to say that somebody's Twitter handle is Grenade O'Connor is tweeting, I have to pay $5 a month for John Dankosky to follow me. Well worth it. See, I think that's a different thing. Yeah, I would follow you probably for $5 too, but that's like a completely different kind of transaction. That's not getting big business involved. We should take a quick break, I think, and so we can jump over to iTanya. We want to have a lot of time to talk about that. Very interesting movie. Not really even sure how everybody here feels about it yet.
I want you to tweet me. Follow me on Twitter. Follow me on Twitter. Yeah. I want you to tweet me.
All right, so now we're moving over to a new release, a movie called I, Tonya. Margot Robbie is probably somewhere in the hunt for Best Actress, where she's nominated. Allison Janney, who plays her mother, Lavanna Golden, is something close to a front runner for the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress, probably bumping heads a little bit with Laurie Metcalf from Lady Bird. We can talk about that if we have time. Let's begin by hearing those two actresses in particular. You're going to hear Margot Robbie as Tonya Harding, Allison Janney as her mother, in one of their typical loving exchanges.
Did you... I mean, when I was a kid, did you ever love me or anything?
You think Sonia Henie's mother loved her? Poor you. I didn't stay home making apple brown Bettys. No, I made you a champion. Knowing you'd hate me for it. That's the sacrifice a mother makes. I wish I'd had a mother like me instead of nice. Nice gets you. I didn't like my mother either. So what? I gave you a gift.
You cursed me. You're a monster.
Spilled milk, baby.
All right, so there you have it. One of their typical exchanges. Producer Jonathan McNichol is pointing out, let's be clear, this is supposedly a comedy. I'm not even sure I agree that... Oh, first of all, let's say something, that history is being made here. This is the first time that Carolyn Payne has ever been on this show to talk about a movie, which we did not force her to go see.
True.
She had actually been to see the movie and would have gone to see the movie no matter what.
I saw this movie weeks ago on my own volition. I was still on crutches. I left my house in the dead of winter on crutches. I hobbled like clubbed Nancy Kerrigan to this movie on my own. Well, I mean, not on my...
So why would that be? Why this movie?
I was intrigued by it. I remember the Nancy Kerrigan, Tonya Harding scandal. I'm from Massachusetts, and so Nancy Kerrigan was, you know, the little prized Olympic treasure. And I remember that whole thing, and I just thought the movie struck me as looking really interesting. And I had read how the style of it, where it's sort of this, like, documentary but sort of like mockumentary. I'm a big fan of those Christopher Guest movies, which this reminded me of. I found it to be funny. I was laughing in the theater. At first no one else was, but I right from the first scene, and I liked this movie a lot. Yeah. And I am excited that this is the first time, this is in a long time, that I can say that I liked a movie I had to see for this show.
I was excited to see it too.
Yeah.
Say why. And what is the movie to you? Like, what do you think this movie's about?
I do think that it would be categorized as comedy, not slapstick, you know, dark comedy.
Mm-hmm. That's like my favorite kind of comedy.
Right. I actually had met someone who was a former figure skater, and we were talking about figure skating and the competition and all that, and it just made me interested. I was pretty young when the scandal was going down, so it really kind of went over my head. And in a way, I'm glad, because when I was watching the movie, I kind of wasn't trying to associate any sort of factual analogy. I was just kind of watching it almost as a narrative storytelling, just as a regular movie.
All right. And Rand, how about you?
So I thought that was a great clip to play from the movie, because if you didn't know anything about this movie and you only heard that clip, it would be unimaginable to you this could be a comedy.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a single note in fact that what we just heard is really a horrifying and a portrayal of a degraded and terrible mother-daughter relationship.
Although I would quickly say that I remember being in the theater and laughing when she says, "Do you think Sonia Henie's mother loved her?"
Yeah.
I did laugh at that. Anyway, continue.
Well, so to me, what this is about, I think each of us could maybe give a one-sentence summary of what this is about. One of the things this is about is, what is it like to be reduced to sort of a one- or two-line joke in the cultural conversation? And 20 years later, what is it like to have been, you know, that person all along? It's also about the difficulty of lives that come from the sort of bottom edge of the lower middle class. It's about the difficulty of a working class life. It's about abuse of different kinds, abuse from your mother, marital abuse. She's beaten up by various people. But it's also funny. I mean, the real Jonathan McNichol put the question to us in one of the emails. the whole time I was asking myself, is this movie humanizing all these people, or is it making fun of all these people, or is it doing both things at once, which is a very hard thing to do. I have, by the way, a similar set. I think that question also would apply to the three billboards outside Ebbing. Mm-hmm. And the films bear some relation to each other. I think people are going to – I tend to like, in this regard, my categories kept separate. And although I did laugh at some things, I also at sometimes felt the film was coming perilously close to sort of committing the problem that in part it's inveighing against. And it partly is about what happens when you become an object of mockery. But there's also a kind of mockery, productively even, that attaches to – that exists within the film itself. So I liked – sometimes you can't necessarily justify or explain fully why you think something works. I kind of did think it worked, but the more I can talk myself out of it.
But it could have gone so wrong. This movie just could have gone. I think that's what I admired about it. Like, it didn't become just kind of this comedy and mockery. It does have that, like I said, there's that mockumentary
element.
And
it's not Christopher Guest.
Right, it's
like,
not
there. Like, that scene that we listened to could not be in Christopher Guest. It's way too intense.
Yeah, although, did you see For Your Consideration? That gets very dark, that Christopher Guest movie about making
I think that movie, that particular movie, has an actual contempt for some of the characters that it has created in a way that really bothered me and that we're sort of hinting at a little bit here. I mean, one of my problems with this movie, Parker, was I do feel like it almost kind of violates the premise of its title in the sense that I think it's a lot more interested in Jeff Galluli and LaVonna Golden, the mother, and the role of the press and some of the other subsidiary characters. I feel the person that I get to know the least in some ways is Tonya Harding. I walk out of the movie not really understanding her better. And if anybody is flattened into cardboard in this movie, I feel like it's her. But I don't know. That could be just me. What was your take on that?
It was interesting that you brought that up because I never thought of it that way before because the movie does revolve around her. But I see it from your point of view. In a way, it's everything is happening to her. And some of the things act as a foil to her character. But really, she's sort of moving through it. But it seemed the tone of the movie and the way that they chose to break the fourth wall at certain elements when they interjected humor, you know, that sort of tongue-in-cheek sort of tone, I feel like it was trying to be as ambivalent as possible, which is why it's such a frustrating movie to watch in a way. The movie does partially kind of portray her as basically a punchline, as you said, or the object to which things happen, and that's the way the movie treats her too, just like, you know, her life would reflect that as well.
Carolyn, let me try this out and tell me what you think. I was really, really happy at the end. I'm not always happy when they do things like this, but I was very happy at the end where one of the things they showed you was actual footage of the real Tonya Harding skating in her absolute prime, pulling off this maneuver that nobody else had pulled off. And you really saw her, you know, just how great she really was despite everything that she had going against her. And I feel like the movie kind of almost skips over that for me. The movie portrays her as a person who's a really good skater, but mainly who's really angry all the time about the way that her skating goes unrecognized or the superficial elements having to do with how she presents herself and the music she chooses and the outfits she wears and the fact she doesn't have enough money to look as good as some of the other skaters. And it almost skips over like how good she really is other than her constantly saying how good she really is. But I don't know. That could be my own personal reaction to it.
I mean, so I was young. I was a kid when this happened, but I was into figure skating. I remember liking to watch it. And if you had asked me before this movie where I saw this and then kind of, you know, you fall down the rabbit hole, you go home and you're Googling and you're watching old videos. If you had asked me to talk about Tonya Harding before this and said, like, you know, name three things about her, I would have been like crispy, bleached yellow bangs, tacky costumes, like, and hit Nancy Kerrigan in the knee. That's what I would have said. So I do think that this movie kind of shows how that would have been a very common perception of her. I don't think like that would have been an off base, and that is too bad because then when you go back and watch her skate and you know like that she was one of 10 women to do a triple axel, and when they show that in this movie, I think like the movie, to me, I felt, it made me feel awful for how I thought about her all this time. And I saw her as not like a punchline, but like a punching bag throughout this.
And she literally becomes
literally,
a punching bag.
She is,
the closing
just for
scene
everyone.
Of the film are about her engaging in these boxing spectacles because she has to make money.
But like
so
her
she's
whole life.
Using her last little bit of notoriety to do that. But I think,
but
Colin,
she also,
your question.
She has been physically punched all of her life.
And she's
first
been
by
physically
her mother
punched
and
also,
by her.
So it's mm-hmm. like a professionalizing of the abuse that she's suffered. But I do think that it was very canny of the filmmakers to do this. At the end, you have this juxtaposition of scenes of her getting hit in the boxing match. You see her feet in the boxing shoes, and then we also see her doing in slow motion this triple axel, which was the great jump and that she made her name with. And it's done in slow motion, and it's very, very beautiful. By the way, I wondered how did they do this with the act? I mean, with the actress, they made it look so real.
Oh, there's
she
actually
obviously
a great
can't
article
do
where they
things.
Talk about the visual effects
right.
that they use.
But they really do convey the beauty of her skating. And all films about sports, they have to decide how much time are we going to devote to actually showing the sport. You tend to like the films often where they don't show that much, but they show a lot here. Mm-hmm. And it's done very well, and it conveys beauty. I thought that was one of the good things about it. But, you know, with the Allison Janney portrayal, what's emblematic of this film is that she's both portraying a very harrowing mother figure, but also a parody of a harrowing mother figure. And this film double tracks in that it gives you both the reality of something and a sort of parody of it at the same time. That's very hard to do.
Yeah. Right. The movie that it reminds me the most of, I think I said this in an email, is the movie to Die For, which is also based on a real case. This is the movie where Nicole Kidman plays a scheming TV weatherwoman who induces a hapless suitor, played by Joaquin Phoenix, to kill her husband, played by Matt Dillon. And there's a lot of talking to the camera, and there's a lot of stuff about class and rising up through class and stuff like that. And there's a lot of what you're describing, too, which is this is a pretty serious story, which is doubled back on for the purposes of parody at times, too, which I don't know. I mean, I can enjoy that movie. Actually, Parker, you used the word frustrating. What did you mean by frustrating?
Frustrating tonally, mostly. Mm-hmm. There were times when it had that very tongue-in-cheek Wes Anderson kind of feel to it. You know, even some of the photography and the way that the shots were done reflected that. So you get in this mindset that you're expecting some sort of very ironic take on something. But then at times the script is very, very bleak, like the clip that we listened to before, that really is more like a spotlight kind of feel. And sometimes when they butted up against each other, it felt like they just didn't fit right. Or it made you feel very conflicted, but not in a way that was profound, just sort of like, this doesn't feel quite right.
There's an earlier film of the Craig Gillespie, the director, also directed a film called Lars and the Real Girl.
Mm-hmm.
Did you guys see that?
I like that movie.
With Ryan Gosling. Yeah. And he plays a socially withdrawn, inept, maybe spectrum-y person who develops a relationship, a full-blown romantic relationship with a life-size, anatomically correct doll. Now, there's nothing, more inherently mockable than that. And part of the film is the extent to which he is mocked by everyone around him. But the film finds this magic way through taking this inherently ridiculous theme, but also plumbing it for serious sympathy. So that's clearly one thing this director does. He's trying to balance the parodic and the sympathetic, and that's an interesting task.
How do people feel about, we're going to have to wrap this up pretty fast, but how about Margot Robbie herself? I'll just lay my cards on the table. I think she's I think one of the reasons she was picked was because she was athletic enough to start those skating sequences, even if they were going to CGI mm-hmm. and some other stuff and everything, but she could she could be on camera for some of the beginnings of it. But she's kind of iconically beautiful, and it seems to me that part of Tonya Harding's struggle is that Nancy Kerrigan was more iconically beautiful than Tonya could ever be.
Yeah, I thought she did a solid job. I would kind of agree with you, Colin, that there was something I think if you would cast another actress in this role, it wouldn't have hurt the film. It could have only added to it. But I do think that she did an amazing job in that she did learn to skate for this movie. She was, she's athletic, but she didn't know how to skate. And I think that it was impressive that she did that. And I think that she did bring – I think she was at her best playing the older Tonya Harding in the – where in the narrator role where she's doing that kind of like to the camera interview. I thought that was strong. That was some I really enjoyed her in those moments.
Mm. Well, we should probably stop here so we'll have time to make some recommendations and some endorsements. The movie is I, Tonya. You should definitely go see it if you are interested in the Oscars and who's going to get them. And you should probably go see it anyway. It has its frustrating qualities. I would agree with Parker, but overall, I think there's a lot to get out of it. Of course, there's also a Sufjan Stevens song about Tonya Harding. Of course there is. But it takes one to know one, and God only knows what you are. Just some Portland white trash. You can find it.
This whole conversation is making me feel bad about the time I hit Carl Castle with a cricket bat. I was just trying to get ahead. Today's show was produced by Bruno McPants and me, Kyone Wolf. Most of Amanda Fish's 2 million Twitter followers are plankton. The part of Bill Curry was played by Scott Hamilton. On Monday, the scramble leaves the pocket and looks at Super Bowl commercials. And now, back to Colin.
You know, one thing I forgot to point out in the preceding segment is that, I mean, Tonya Harding, maybe just because this story became kind of ripe in a certain way, there's been an awful lot of revisiting of this story of late. There was a play called Tea at the American Theater Company. There's been an opera. There is a documentary, the part of the 30 for 30 series on ESPN called The Price of Gold. Yes, there's Tonya and Nancy, the rock opera. Tonya Harding, the musical. That's sort of a flat-out comedy written in connection with the Upright Citizens Brigade and on and on and on. So there's some way in which that – and I would also lump in Nicole Muley's opera about Amy Fisher, who I think is sort of the other Tonya-like character from that era. There's some way in which we're – coming back to this kind of material and kind of repalpating it. All right, it's time to recommend some things. So, Rand, why don't you go first?
So I'm going to recommend two books. One that just came to mind when we were talking about cultural appropriation. And I may have endorsed this book one time a couple of years ago, but it's the kind of book that can use repeated endorsement. It's a mid-70s novel called Oreo by a forgotten, now forgotten writer named Fran Ross, an African-American writer who died of cancer shortly after writing that book. And it was reissued a few years ago, and it sort of represents the triumph of cultural appropriation in that it combines blaxploitation narratives with Jewish humor, absurdism. It's also a kind of classic Bildungsroman in a way. There are these Joycean-like linguistic puns everywhere. And it sort of owes about in equal parts as much to Shaft as it does to James Joyce. And it's a kind of novel you really – what can you say about – it's cultural appropriation, except stand aside and marvel. So it's called Oreo by Fran Ross. The other book, on a much more somber note, I guess, I've spent some time recently interviewing a woman who lives in Bloomfield named Karen Stahl, S-T-A-H-L. She wrote a book called The Option. Her daughter, 15 years ago in young adulthood, took her own life. And she had an anxiety disorder that was insufficiently reckoned with and treated. And the book is about the aftermath, of both the immediate and longer term, of losing your only child in this way, and how her mother, Karen Stahl, went back. Her daughter was a would-be writer, and she had many, many books and notebooks. And her mother, the book is partly a search through her daughter's writings to understand posthumously, to understand her better. But it's also about reconstituting your own life. Karen Stahl has gotten very much involved in groups, support groups of people who've faced this problem. It's a beautifully written book. It's heartbreaking, but it's also very helpful and in its own way spiritually inspired. It's called The Option by Karen Stahl.
Parker Hu, what would you like to recommend?
This is not particularly new, but there's an article that was on BBC Future from a while back. It was called Objects Designed to Be as Uncomfortable as Possible, which I like to refer to as iSyphilis for Designers. It takes the Greek designer Katerina Comprari, I hope that I'm pronouncing that correctly. She designed a set of objects that basically everyday objects, but turned into things that are completely impractical and just basically bend your mind. For example, there's a a watering pot with the spout turned inwards over the top. Just crazy things like that, but I like it very much because it's a great daily reminder of how everyday objects really have a ton of thinking behind them, but we tend not to think about it too much.
It kind of goes with the Donald Norman book, right? There's even the thing called the Norman door, which is the door, you can't figure out how the door works. The door, you push the door, you're supposed to pull the door.
Right, like that. The famous book, Design of Everyday Things.
There you go.
That's right.
All right, and Carolyn Payne, what are you going to recommend?
All right, I have two endorsements. One, I like can't actually say the title on air. I've endorsed this before. It rhymes with Pitt's Creek. Mm-hmm. It's on Pop Network. Eugene Levy and his son co-wrote and co-created this show. Catherine O'Hara is in it. It is so brilliant. You can watch the previous seasons on Netflix. It is just a great piece. It's like a great indoor, if you're, you know, a winter shut-in like I am forced to be right now. It's just something great. And also, if you are venturing out, Roundabout Theater in New York has a play right now, Amy and the Orphans. And it is a new play, and I happen to know one of the actors in it. It is a play that deals with disabilities. And there are two main actors that alternate, and they both have Down syndrome. And Eddie Barbanel is my mom's best friend's son. And he is an actor, a professional actor with Down syndrome. And it is a really well done. I've seen it in previews. And it is a really amazing piece of theater. So definitely check that out if you are in the city.
All right. First of all, I want to thank everybody who's on the nose today. That's Rand Richards Cooper, contributing editor at Commonweal, writes the In Our Midst column for Hartford Magazine. Parker Hu, graphic designer who performs in a bunch of local bands, making her nose debut today. And a triumphant debut it was. Her new solo album, Late Reply, is available at parkerwho.bandcamp.com. Carolyn Payne is an injured actress, injured comedian, and injured dancer, but she's recovering. True. She's going to come back and take over the world. I'll make a few endorsements. First of all, I want to endorse the actress Julianne Nicholson, who I just have this intense fondness for in everything. In I, Tonya, she plays Diane Rawlinson, who is the skating coach of Tonya Harding, and the person who's trying to bridge the gap between Tonya's kind of heavy metal and Richard Marx-loving, tacky music, tacky outfits thing, and the more rarefied world of skating, most of which, by the way, is inhabited by skaters who come from very modest backgrounds but are able to acquire the trappings, anyway, of higher class. So anyway, Julianne Nicholson, she's like really great in anything you ever see. Once you get used to her, you'll know to look for her. I was also thinking about a skating thing that goes along with this. Right around the time, exactly at the time of Tonya Harding, there was another skater. She was French and she was black. Her name was Surya Bonaly. And at the time, I was just completely knocked out by her. And she, in addition to doing some of these things that Tonya Harding could do something that's actually illegal in skating, which is a flip. She would, on skates, flip up in the air, rotate around and land on her skates. It's incredibly dangerous to do. And she would sometimes do it in exhibitions. And every once in a while, she would do it as kind of an up yours to judges who she – like Tonya Harding, she felt that she was not understood, that she was being judged by the wrong set of standards, that she could always do the technical stuff and then would get artistic points taken off and stuff like that. So Radiolab did a really great piece on this. So it's easy to track down on the Radiolab site, the story of Surya Bonaly. I've been thinking a little bit about Philadelphia because of the Super Bowl tomorrow. I would recommend if you don't really sort of if you haven't got a good grasp on sort of Philadelphia Eagles weirdness of their fans, you could certainly watch the movie Silver Linings Playbook, which kind of gets at this. I mean, Robert De Niro in particular plays that kind of Eagles fan that you don't want to be anywhere near during a game. The Philadelphia Eagles, the only sports franchise to at one point have an actual court, like a real court with a judge and a jail underneath the stands because so many of their fans engaged in criminal behavior that had to be addressed in a very prompt and expeditious manner. And then if you really want to go to town on Philadelphia depravity, and Carolyn, I bet you know this one, there's a very famous clip of the comedian Bill Burr who was on a lineup of comedians who were all getting booed in Philadelphia. One after another were booed off the stage. Almost nobody could finish their set. And Burr got out there with a plan that he was going to finish his set, but he wasn't going to do his actual comedy set. He was going to spend the entire time berating the Philadelphia audience in the most visceral, politically incorrect, rude, scatological, profane, and angry terms. And he did that. He stays out there for the entire 12 minutes. The entire time he's reminding the crowd how much longer he's going to be out there, and that he's not leaving. And, I mean, it's not for the faint of heart, and it's really politically incorrect, but in terms of one man taking on an entire city, it's maybe worth listening to. Thanks very much to Parker and Rand and Carolyn, and we'll be back on Monday with a scramble.